You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Is this country ready for a woman president? Madeline M. Cunin would like to think so. Ms. Cunin was the first woman ever elected governor of Vermont some 24 years ago, and she was reelected for two additional terms, another first for women in American politics. In her latest book, Pearls, Politics, and Power, Ms. Cunin examines the challenges still faced by women seeking elective office in this country, in particular those faced by Hillary Clinton, whom Madeline Cunin has endorsed. Her book is published by Chelsea Green, and I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Cunin to my show today. I wasn't sure whether to call you professor, governor, or ambassador, because you've been all, but currently professor.
Right, right. I'm not fussy about titles.
I've said that you'd like to think we're ready for a woman president, but that's different from believing we're actually ready to elect one. Are you surprised that we're still even discussing this issue so many years after you became Vermont's first female governor?
Yes, I am surprised that it is a big question, sometimes asked publicly and sometimes people just thinking it to themselves. You know, when I first was elected governor of Vermont in 1984, I thought there'd be a huge parade of women marching behind me. And now I turned around, and of course there are some, but they're not in the quantity that you might expect so many years later. So it is still a question. The good news is that there are more women governors. There are about 9 women governors today. The good news is that for the first time in our history, an African-American and a woman are the top contenders for the Democratic nomination. So nobody would have thought that just 2 years ago. So, and the polls have
although
changed.
Although a white man still may win.
That I must try to remember. But obviously, that's in the mix. And we don't know how this is going to play out. We do know it has opened up new conversations in this country about racism and about sexism. And overall, that's probably healthy that we are having these debates.
Well, it's one thing to be elected mayor of a town or even of a city or even governor. But when it comes to becoming president, people start getting all involved in the stereotypes. Women aren't tough or decisive enough to govern the most powerful nation in the world.
It's true. You know, running for a state legislature today is pretty much a non-issue, whether you're a woman or an African-American, depending somewhat on the district that you're running from, and the Congress. We're used to seeing women there. Nancy Pelosi, you know, had a tremendous impact being up there as the speaker. And suddenly, you know, the United States Congress looks different. Instead of a sign that once had been scrawled on the treehouse fort that said, "Girls keep out," when you see Nancy Pelosi in the background at the President's State of the Union speech, you know that women are now welcome. But when it comes to president, the game changes, simply because we've never had one in the United States.
But even on the local level, I support a group called the WCF, which tries to get more women into elected office, bipartisan. And this year I was seated at a table with a woman who had run for mayor of Allentown, Pennsylvania, the third largest city in Pennsylvania. And she said that she was asked to speak before the Rotary Club, and her opponent was, and he gave his speech, and the whole audience was elderly male. And when it came her turn, she started talking about her ideas about how to fix the city. And the president of the Rotary Club stopped her and said, "Wait a minute, we have to find out one thing. Everybody wants to know. What are your measurements?"
Really?
And this was very recently.
Wow. That is kind
of shocking.
She
was stunned, she said. She was
surprised.
Well,
yes, but you know, a man may say that, but there are a lot of boos in the crowd, I suspect. When somebody does. At least I hope so.
She said it didn't even make the local newspaper.
Really? That's amazing. Well, of course, we've had stories with Hillary where the Washington Post wrote a story by a female reporter about Hillary's cleavage. You know, so, and interestingly enough, at that speech, not a word was said about what she actually talked about. And that's the frustration.
Well, there also are the expectations that people have. Women are expected to be warm and collaborative, and they're expected to be strong on education, health, and the environment, but weak on crime, jobs, the economy, taxes, and national security.
Yeah, those are gender assumptions or gender stereotypes. It's just where we see, you know, where women are strong on certain issues dealing with family. In the old days, they called them the hearth issues in Vermont. And they are much more challenged on economic issues, on security issues. And the interesting thing in this campaign for president is that, at least for the time being, Hillary Clinton has been stronger on being capable of being commander-in-chief, and nobody expected that. Of course, she's paid a price for that on the other end of the spectrum and not being considered feminine enough or nice enough or soft enough or emotional.
And we'll get into that in Iraq in just a moment, but I wanted to point out that Anna Quinlan has said that the words calculating and ambitious are never used to describe a male politician because voters assume that he will be those things. It's not an issue, but when it's used against a woman, it is used in a negative way.
Yeah, very much so. And I think we just have trouble meshing our images of a traditional woman, a traditional leader, especially for president, who has always been male, and a woman candidate for president. So it's just something disconnects. Not saying it can't be done. I don't want to be pessimistic about that, but it's different.
Well, some people have told you and told me that they'd vote for a woman, but not for Hillary. Isn't it possible that some people just don't like her?
Sure, that's possible.
I did a show recently with a number of feminist intellectuals who said they felt that way. So what happens? Do you think that a vote for Barack Obama or John McCain would be a vote against women in high office, an expression of sexism? Or could it just be that this is not the right woman?
Well, it's a tough question because it's impossible to untangle the two strands. You know, Hillary Clinton as a person and Hillary Clinton as the first serious female candidate for president. So we can never have a definitive answer on that one. What we can say, though, is that gender still matters. In some cases, it's advantageous to be a female candidate because she's obviously getting strong female support. But in other cases, it's a disadvantage. And the I don't like her part is very hard to assess because some of that goes back to she's tough and that she's not feminine enough. And then also women may have impossible expectations of a woman candidate. She has to be perfect. You know, if she fails, we all fail. And so I think there's some anxiety about that, just as some Jews felt when Senator Lieberman was running. They got a little nervous. Is it going to be bad for us if he doesn't succeed?
Or if he turned out to be Joe Lieberman. Madeline Kunin, her book, Pearls, Politics, and Power, How Women Can Win and Lead, is published by Chelsea Green. Well, Hillary Clinton has been criticized for her vote to authorize going to war in Iraq, and you have included an observation in the book about that decision by Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, author of The Double Blind. She told you that Hillary Clinton's position on the war has gone a long way towards solidifying her as commander-in-chief.
It probably did amongst one constituency, but alienated her from another constituency. So she no doubt voted for the Iraq war for many reasons. One, having seen the buildup of danger in Iraq when Bill Clinton was president. Two, giving the president the benefit of the doubt. But a third factor may have been, I can't be soft on this issue. And it may very well have been part of her decision-making process.
But if the vote was a mistake, as many people have come to believe, is that the sort of decision-making that we would want from a commander-in-chief, male or female?
Well, that's a tough one as well, but I don't think she could have apologized for that vote in the
same
way.
People didn't want her to apologize.
Yeah, people did want her to, and Edwards, of course, did. But then you fall into that other category of women can't make up their minds. They're indecisive. So there are a lot of ways when we assess women, and when I say we, both women and men, because we all have been educated and culturated by gender stereotypes, whether we're conscious of them or not. But she's sort of damned, falls into damned if you do and damned if you don't. You know, you're either too tough or too soft. You're either indecisive or too decisive. And, you know, there are a lot of very tough calls.
Was Senator Clinton similarly trying to solidify an image of toughness when she misspoke recently about having faced sniper fire in Bosnia when she actually visited a peaceful airfield and met children on the tarmac? I've always wondered why any politician would inflate the record, making claims that just a little bit of research would prove to be untrue.
Yeah, I have no idea what was going on in her head at that moment.
Have you ever been tempted? You know, you were in a tight spot and you said, yeah, well, I graduated magna cum laude from my university when you didn't.
Well, not in that category. I think sometimes, you know, I guess what we have to recognize, all of these candidates are incredibly tired. They've been campaigning night and day. All of them have made some mistakes. And whether this mistake is worse than other mistakes is hard to say. But, you know, she may have been warned, for all we know, ahead of time that she might face sniper fire. And then it sort of crept into her head. Or maybe she did just want to say, I've been there. I've been in danger. And it's too bad that that misstatement occurred, frankly.
Studies have shown that male politicians who express anger will get rewarded for it. Female politicians get penalized for it. What was that something that you thought about when you were governor? Boy, this is really upsetting me, but I'd better watch myself.
Well, when I was governor, I knew I had to keep my emotions under control. And the big litmus test then was, can a woman cry? And it is still a litmus test, can a woman cry?
People notice when Hillary cries and when she doesn't cry.
Right, and some people thought it was great that what they call the Ice Maiden, which she's not, suddenly melted and almost shed a tear. And John Edwards at the time said, well, it shows she can't be commander-in-chief. So anger, yes, I think the danger is that, you know, everybody's had women in their lives. They've had mothers, they've had mothers-in-law, they've had sisters and daughters and aunts and teachers. And, you know, a woman politician can remind people of an angry mother telling you, no, you can't do that. Or I think angry women do affect people differently than angry men. I think anger in a man is considered strength. Anger in a woman is sometimes threatening.
My guest is Madeline M. Kunin, whose latest book is Pearls, Politics and Power, How Women Can Win and Lead. It's published by Chelsea Green. We will continue, no relation, by the way, to Chelsea Clinton, that publisher. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Madeline M. Kunin, former governor of Vermont, former ambassador to Switzerland, and nowadays the Marsh Scholar Professor at Large at the University of Vermont and founder of the Institute for Sustainable Communities. She has written a book called Pearls, Politics and Power, How Women Can Win and Lead, and it is published by Chelsea Green. What inspired you to get involved in electoral politics?
Well, a lot of things. One was, if we go back to the early 70s, there were two movements at the time, the women's movement and the environmental movement. And I got caught up in both. And the women's movement told me, sort of gave me permission. I had four children, one quite young. And you know, the rallying cry of those days was, get out there. You can change the world. And I took it seriously.
And what were your big issues at the time?
Well, at that time, the Equal Rights Amendment mm-hmm. was the big issue. And I had lobbied for the Equal Rights Amendment as a citizen before the legislature. And I thought, well, instead of knocking on the door from the outside and pleading, maybe I can get a seat at the table. And then the environmental movement was very big in Vermont, and I wanted to be there to vote on those issues. And, you know, there were some practical considerations. There was an open seat, which is always helpful in politics. And, you know, much later, I began to think that one of the reasons I got involved was because of my background. I was born in Switzerland, came to the United States as a child with my mother and brother, left because of the threat of the Holocaust. And I think that gave me a sense of mission in a way. Also, the immigrant experience. Every young child, I think, still hears at the dinner table, anything is possible in America. And my mother gave me that gift.
Well, you also, in Vermont, which is unlike other states of this union, perhaps more likely to elect someone whose platform was similar to yours.
Yes, though Vermont was much more conservative in those days than it is now.
There was no Bernie Sanders.
Sanders, and I think, you know, a real minority of Democrats. But it was hospitable in another way, in that it's a small state. You don't have to raise a lot of money to run for the legislature. And you can do retail politics, you know, knocking on doors.
We got a comment from a listener who says that it's pretty sad to think the United States might not be ready for a female president when so many other countries, many considered third world, have female leaders.
It is, and it's hard to explain. But again, we don't know whether it's just the gender thing going on, and we don't know what the outcome of this election will be yet. So don't feel sad just yet. And a lot of other countries have quotas that they have initiated, and their parliamentary systems where quotas can work, where you can ask parties to put women's names on lists. Very hard to do that in our system.
Some people have said they oppose Hillary Clinton's candidacy because they believe she's relied on her husband to get where she is, that her experience is largely limited to what a first lady is witness to. And then when she did have a chance to set policy, she blew it with an ill-conceived health plan. Are those legitimate concerns?
Sure. They're out there, and I've heard them as well. And, you know, the question is, could she have done it without Bill? And is Bill an asset or a liability? I mean, I think in this campaign we've seen he's actually been both. I mean, the name recognition clearly is a huge asset and still is.
And many people love him and remember the surpluses during his presidency.
Right, right. There were some good times in the 90s. But they also question, could she have done it on her own? If I were to have to choose and answer that question, yes or no, I would say yes, she could have done it. But of course, we'll never know because she was always outstanding. I mean, she was outstanding at Wellesley. She had a terrific career. She's obviously politically gifted, but it's an impossible question to answer. And a lot of women do and have historically gotten into politics, gotten their foot in the door through their husbands. So it's not unusual in that sense, but of course we all like to believe we've moved beyond that, and I think by and large we have.
Well, there's that other concern that people have, the same sort of concern that was expressed in Argentina during their recent election. Would Bill get too involved in her presidency, and would anybody want to become vice president in a White House where Bill and Hillary are kind of sharing the power?
Yes. I mean, we'll never know.
Well,
exactly.
But this is a woman's problem, isn't it?
Well, yes. I think again, you know, the spouse, if you will, is more of an issue for a female candidate than it is for a male candidate. Because until recently, female spouses have not had their own careers or businesses or financial dealings, but that's changing. So, the spouse role, you know, even joking about what do we call him, you know, first man, first whatever. People are kind of flummoxed over that.
What did they call your husband when you were governor?
They just called him by his name, actually.
Maybe that's what we have to do.
Occasionally he was introduced as the first man, but mostly in jest. And, you know, Vermont seemed to get used to the idea fairly easily.
You mentioned that Hillary Clinton is the first serious candidate. She's not obviously not the first woman to run for president of the United States. In fact, between 1872 and 2004, you point out, 21 women have thrown their hats in the ring. But she's the first one to have actually entered with the idea that she wants to win. The others had other reasons for running?
Well, the ones we remember best are Shirley Chisholm from New York, and she had tremendous courage at that time, and she took it straight to the convention. She got, I think, 20-something electoral votes, and then Carol Moseley Braun, who also, I think, felt she was serious, but I think realistically they knew they didn't have a chance. But we have to be grateful to them because they helped pave the way.
Well, Shirley Chisholm, who won 151 votes in the 1972 Democratic primary.
Right.
Yeah. She said sexism was more of a handicap than racism in the presidential race.
Yes, she did. And she was criticized for that by the African-American community. But interestingly enough, when I asked Carol Moseley Braun that question, she agreed with Shirley Chisholm that gender still is more of a gut issue. You know, you grow up with it than race. Doesn't do much good to debate these issues because you only get people angry. But I think what you can do is make people sensitive to the idea that gender is out there, whether we talk about it or not. It affects, it creates like a prism through which you see people.
My guess is Madeline M. Kunin, her latest book, I can say that. How many other books?
Two.
This one is Pearls, Politics and Power, How Women Can Win and Lead. It's published by Chelsea Green. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Getting back to why we don't see more women in elected politics, we sure have a fair number who have reached the highest levels. Two female secretaries of state, Madeleine Albright and Condoleezza Rice, a female attorney general, Janet Reno. We have two women on the Supreme Court. Oh, did Sandra Day O'Connor, and now Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But then when we get to elective offices, it suddenly just drops off. You would have thought that it would spill over.
I would have thought that, certainly. And what's dismaying is when you compare the United States with the rest of the world, we're at an all-time high in the percentage of women in the United States Congress, 16%. Interestingly, that figure came up two other times. The number of women in top corporate positions is also 16%. And in an evaluation of 187 countries, the average number of women in the lower houses of parliament is also 16%. It's like a new ceiling. But the United States, in that lineup of other countries, ranks 67th out of 187 countries. And you say, what's going on here? You mentioned Argentina. Argentina not only has a woman president, but 40% of its parliament is female. And the country, you know, this is a trick question. If I were to ask you which country has the highest percentage of women, you might say one of the Scandinavian countries who have traditionally done very well. But the top country is Rwanda. And the women of Rwanda, after the genocide, said to themselves, enough is enough. So they demanded a quota in their constitution. They far exceeded it. 48.8% of their parliament is female. And when I spoke to a senator for Rwanda and asked, you know, why? She said, we knew we had to do this for the survival of our children.
Yeah, well, that country has gone through such a serious trauma. It probably was more open to this kind of a major change. But you would think that in a country like the United States, where women make up more than half the population, that women would vote more for female candidates, even if men resisted. But it doesn't always work out that way either.
Well, I think,
are women caught up in the same stereotypes?
Yes, they are caught up in the stereotypes. But I think it's not so much that people won't vote for them. There are two things really at work. One is the power of incumbency, that we have such terribly low turnover rate in the Congress.
Well, you were reelected twice, so.
Right. I can't complain. But in the Congress, as you know, it's considered a lifetime sinecure. So the other is that women don't naturally think of running for office. They may be active in their communities. They do all kinds of good works for charities, for causes of every stripe. But when you ask them to run for office, they pause. You know, they pause. Do I really want to do this? Can I do this? And one of the things we've learned, as you learned at the Women's Campaign Fund at Now Forum, women have to be asked more than men.
Yeah, you say that this is kind of like, this is acculturation. It's almost like sex.
Right, right. You don't want to be forward. You don't want to be arrogant. You don't want to show that you want power, because power is such a electric word.
So people have to come to you and say, Madeline, we really would love for you to run for senator of Vermont. And then you have to decide yes or no, as opposed to many male candidates who say, you know, I think I'd make a great senator, and that's that. The exceptions are where women feel that they have a really important issue, and there's just no other way to get the thing addressed.
Right. Very often women are passionately engaged in an issue, and that propels them into the public arena. That's a good route, because once you're there, you see the whole array of issues that you have to get involved with. But I think there's, you know, aside from being almost shy, if that's the right word, or reticent may be the better word, I also think a lot of young women wonder, can you really get something done? You know, they look at the political system, they look at all the compromises you have to make, and they're not sure they want to do that.
Well, then they look at Nancy Pelosi and see somebody who has risen to incredible power. You said that there was an increase in the number of women who ran for office. By the way, Nancy Pelosi comes from a political family. Her father was in politics. The number of women in politics increased in 1992 after the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings for the confirmation of Clarence Thomas. How much was that women's reactions to what they felt was the unfair treatment of Anita Hill by a bunch of men?
It was very much due to that. And also, you know, these were televised hearings. So people saw the man on the Judiciary Committee grilling Anita Thomas, and they felt it was an unfair fight.
It was Anita Hill, but
yes,
Clarence Thomas.
Clarence Thomas, sorry.
I just don't want, somebody's going to write in, I guarantee you. You didn't correct her.
How did I say that? All right. Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill.
You misspoke. I thought Hillary was the only one who misspoke.
And I didn't do it on purpose. But that was a powerful image that suddenly hit people. You know, you can hear numbers. You can say, oh, there are only, you know, 16% women in the Congress, and you register that. But then when you see the lineup of the men making the decisions, then it becomes visceral.
You've suggested that candidates can protect themselves from invasions of privacy, which really concerns a lot of women, by revealing personal information about themselves in advance before the press or their opponents can do it for them. And obviously, you wrote this book before Governor Spitzer resigned and before David Paterson took his office. How successful do you think David Paterson's efforts to get those personal secrets out there in the open have been? They still left him open to a lot of criticism,
didn't it? Yeah, vulnerable, but there wasn't the same kind of political explosion that would have occurred if it had been an expose through investigative reporting. And probably the thunderclap was also less because it followed on Spitzer, which was worse in the sense that he paid for sex.
And also, Spitzer, it seemed like a bit of hypocrisy, and that hurt Helen Chenoweth, the conservative congresswoman from, what was it, Utah, when it turned out she was having an adulterous affair after she had supported so much the legislation that punished people for immoral behavior, as she saw it.
Yeah, the worst thing you can do is sound holier than thou. And, you know, proclaim your own virtue and then be felled by the same sword that you were wielding.
One other thing, and I've spoken to a number of women who in politics who have talked about this, women are less likely than men to give money to political candidates, and that's hurt women. There are a number of organizations like Emily's List out there that are trying to redress that situation, but isn't that a real problem?
Well, it's gotten a lot better than it used to. And women are learning that if they want to have influence, they have to be not only at the table in terms of policy, but they have to help a candidate get elected. And it doesn't mean huge contributions. But let's face it, women today, in terms of their earning power, are doing very well, not quite equally to men, but certainly that they can afford to make a political contribution. So I think that's beginning to change. It's not where it should be. But I, for example, when I was running for governor in 1984, I got a lot of contributions from women. They were usually smaller, but that's okay. It's
a lot of small ones add up. That's what
they sure
keeps
do.
Public radio going.
Right. Let's make a plug for that.
In an op-ed piece you wrote for the Washington Post just this past January, you speculated that one reason Hillary Clinton won the Democratic primary in New Hampshire was because those voters are accustomed to having women in their state's legislature, but she lost to Barack Obama in Iowa because that state has elected far fewer women to statewide offices.
Well, there's something going on. I think there's a kind of contagion. When a woman gets elected and women see other women in high office, then they can envision themselves there. And New Hampshire has had a female governor, has a female Speaker of the House, has a female Senate leader, and has the second highest percentage of women in its state legislature. Vermont has the first. Iowa doesn't have that. South Carolina has the lowest percentage of women, 8.8%. Now, it's not the only factor at work, of course. Other things come into play, which may be more important. But it's one of those subtle influences when your psyche asks you, does a woman belong there? And you've seen her on television at night wielding a gavel, you say, sure, no problem.
Because so if you're more comfortable with women, seeing women in office, you're more likely to vote for a woman in office.
Right. And even seeing women in other leadership roles, whether it's presidents of universities or CEOs of corporations, it has a spreading effect, which I think is very valuable.
We would see different kind of government to some degree, not in all cases, because some women would rule or carry out their offices the same as men do. But women do have a tendency to exercise their power differently, don't they? They're more interested
they
in sharing.
And it's an interesting debate because some people say, oh, women don't make a difference because you've got women of all political stripes. And that's true. Of course, why not? It's only natural. But studies have shown that there are some tendencies across party lines. For example, women have promoted women's issues. Women are strong in terms of the environment, education, healthcare. And the reason for that is because they bring their own experiences into the public arena. And there's nothing like a personal story. If you've been a mother and you've been looking for childcare, and you know you can't get to your job if you don't have affordable, reliable childcare. Childcare is not just a simple statistical issue. Childcare is a gut issue whether you can afford your family. So that changes the debate. And more women wouldn't radically change the outcome, but they would tip the balance on some hot issues. As we know, most of the issues of our time that are controversial pass or fail by a few votes.
Well, it's interesting that Americans have said that they want to see less partisanship in politics, although I don't know how you get around it if people disagree on something as basic as whether we should be in Iraq or not. Still, you would think that that would lead them to vote for more women for office.
Yes, but I don't know if they think that way.
And a woman can't say, hey, I'll be less partisan than my opponent.
Right. But the women I talked to and women in Congress all said that they thought women were more likely to work with the opposite party and form coalitions around issues. Maybe they're not in battle form all the time. Maybe they do want to say, we want to solve this problem. Let's see how we can solve it.
You've had a long association with the Clintons. You served as Deputy Secretary of Education during Bill Clinton's first administration Then he appointed you U.S. ambassador to your native Switzerland. And I've heard that you even helped Bill Clinton select Al Gore as a running mate. Is that true?
Well, I served on a three-person committee to recommend the vice president. Obviously, he chose, but we suggested that Al Gore would make a great vice president, and that was his decision.
Well, you didn't know that later Dick Cheney would recommend himself as the vice president. Madeline, you could have been a vice president. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Madeline Kunin's latest book is called Pearls, Politics and Power, How Women Can Win and Lead. It is published by Chelsea Green. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Leonard.